So we've been looking at sexuality in terms of, or we've been looking at wisdom in terms of the book of Proverbs. So we've called our sermon series The Good Life. Proverbs, you know, if you look, just look at the average proverb, you might look at it as kind of like this almost ancient tweet, right? It's like these one-liners that are like pithy and like kind of like, oh, that's nice, like kind of do's and don'ts. But the book of Proverbs is so much more. The book of Proverbs is God's guidebook for our flourishing. It's God's kind of instruction manual for our good life, our flourishing. And in the book of Proverbs, there's kind of this motif of two paths. You can go the path of God's kind of design, the path of wisdom, and that leads to goodness, that leads to flourishing. Or you can go the path of folly. You can follow your own kind of wisdom, the path of folly, and that leads to destruction. So these two paths we're going to look at today in the context of sexuality. And we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 5, which is a chapter all about sexual morality, and it kind of gets at this two paths approach. So turn in your Bibles to Proverbs 5, and we'll read verses 1 through 6, and then 15 through the end of the chapter. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Turn your ear to my words of insight, that you may maintain discretion, and your lips may preserve knowledge. For the lips of the adulterous woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave. She gives no thought to the way of life. Her paths wander aimlessly, but she does not know it. And then skipping up to verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you be ever intoxicated with her love. Why, my son, be intoxicated with another man's wife? Why embrace the bosom of a wayward woman? For your ways are in full view of the Lord, and he examines all your paths. The evil deeds of the wicked ensnare them, and the cords of their sin hold them fast. For lack of discipline, they will die, led astray by their own great folly. This is the word of the Lord. Okay. So I think in this passage, we really do see this kind of two paths approach. Like, wisdom leads to good things, pleasure and happiness, and we see that in this passage. It talks about the joys of sexuality when we're drinking from our own cistern with our own spouse is what that means. But in the same kind of breath in this passage, the writer is very clear that the forbidden woman, the adulterous woman, sex in that direction ensnares us. It leads to death. So I think it's important as we tackle this difficult topic of sexuality that we have this kind of two-pronged approach. Sexuality, sex is a beautiful thing. It's a source of great joy and pleasure when it's in its proper place, when it's on that path of wisdom that God lays out. But it can be a thing of great pain when we take that path of folly, when we go towards the opposite direction of God's design. I like the way that this theologian Ray Ortland puts it in his book, Marriage and the Mystery of the Gospel, commenting on this very passage, Proverbs 5. He says this: the key to understanding the sexual wisdom of Proverbs is to combine both form and freedom, both structure and liberation. A marriage can flourish within both form and freedom because sex is like fire. And listen to this part. Sex is like fire. In the fireplace, it keeps us warm. Outside of the fireplace, it burns the house down. I think that's such a helpful image, and this is kind of the image that I'm going to use throughout my sermon today. Sex is like fire. It's this powerful, wonderful thing, and it can be life-giving and pleasurable when it's in its contained kind of proper place, when it's in the fireplace. When it's not in the proper place, when we take it out of that, it burns the house down. It burns us. It's destructive. So today I want to talk about three questions. I want to look at answering three questions. And the first is this: what is the fireplace of sexuality according to God's design, according to his wisdom? What is that proper place? The second question is, what are the ways that we as individuals and as a culture have taken that fire outside of its proper place and have kind of played with fire in all these different ways and gotten burned? And then third question is, how can we then, as Christians, embrace the countercultural vision and the beauty of God's wisdom for sexuality? In this world that's gone wrong in sexuality, how can we lean into the good kind of form of sexuality in its proper place? Okay, so that first question, what is the fireplace of God's vision, his design for sexuality? Well, before I get to that, I want to just make mention of something that I think is important, and that is that there's been huge consensus in Christian history on this issue. Like, for really the last 1800 years, Christians have been on the same page regarding human sexuality. It's only really in the last few decades that there's been any sort of division or debate within the church about sexual ethics. So for most of Christian history, the fireplace, so to speak, of God's design for sexuality has been clear, both in its proper place and in its proper purpose. So I want to define the fireplace in those terms, the proper place and then the proper purpose for sex. So the proper place, I was looking for kind of a concise, good definition, and Tim Keller, you know, I think he's always a good place to go, and I think he has maybe the best concise definition of the Christian vision of sexual ethics, and he says this in The Meaning of Marriage. The Christian sex ethic can be summarized like this: sex is for use within marriage between a man and a woman. And you know, we could have a whole sermon about defending this claim and kind of going through the scriptures that illustrate this. We don't have time to do that today, but suffice it to say that the Bible is clear and consistent on this. From Genesis 2 in the Old Testament to Matthew 19 in the New Testament when Jesus affirms Genesis 2, to 1 Corinthians 7 and all the Pauline things that Paul says about this, like God, he created sex for the context of the covenantal union of one man and one woman. It's as simple as that. That's the proper place for sexuality. Okay, but what about the proper purpose? What about, what did God create sex for? What's kind of the telos, the end of sex? And for this, I'm going to quote this guy, Todd Wilson. He wrote a book recently called Mere Sexuality, which I highly recommend. It's kind of like an attempt to capture, like, what is that consensus about sexual ethics that Christians have agreed upon for the last 2,000 years. And Todd Wilson says this about the purpose of sex. For the Christian, sex has a dual purpose: to unite and to procreate. It serves to unite two lives in a one-flesh union and to bring forth new life from this one-flesh union. Okay, so that's kind of the definition of the proper place, the proper purpose. But as we know, our culture's view of sexuality has gone very, very far from this. And I want to talk about some of the ways that that we have gone astray from the wisdom of God, from that wise path to the path of folly. I'm going to start by talking about how we've gone astray from the purpose of sexuality, because I think it's helpful to understand that, because when we go astray from the purpose for sex, then it becomes easy to take sex out of its proper place. Okay, so if the purpose of sexuality is this kind of uniting of a man and a woman and for the sake of unity, one flesh, but also procreation, one of the ways our culture has really gone astray is in detaching sex from procreation. So this is actually a really important point to understand a whole myriad of issues. Back in the mid-20th century, the birth control pill was invented. And that was actually a pivotal moment, because what that did was that it detached sex from its logical consequence of having children. Suddenly, sex became less about kind of that biological reality of when two people have sex, they have a child. It became about only really self-expression, self-pleasure, identity. And that was a hugely consequential moment. That gave rise to what we call the sexual revolution in the 1960s, which was this massive moment that really has led to our world today, where sex is detached from the outward orientation, which is its proper orientation of giving of yourself to your spouse outwardly and then producing a new life outwardly. The sexual revolution made sex, it reoriented it inward. Sex became about me and my pleasure, receiving pleasure, kind of consequence-free. It became a consumer commodity. And, you know, we live in a world now, today, where sex is everywhere, and it's tied up with consumerism, right? Movies, media, commercials, it uses sex because that's how we've come to see sex, as a consumer commodity. And this has had huge consequences. It's led to all sorts of things. It's led to, for example, the rise of pornography, because what is pornography except sex as a consumer commodity, right? Detached from any sort of relational context, any sort of attachments, pornography is the epitome of the consequences of sex becoming a thing inwardly of pleasure. It's also led to kind of the casual sex culture, hookup culture, Tinder, which if you don't know what Tinder is, it's this app where you essentially like swipe around looking for like someone you would be interested in having a one-night stand with. Like that's a result of this. Marital infidelity, you know, the rise of divorce, because if sex is only about pleasure, then if your spouse stops kind of providing that to you, then the culture says, well, you can go looking elsewhere for that. And then another result is the rising acceptance of homosexuality. Because, you know, and it's no surprise that this coincided with the rise of birth control. Because when we separated sex from procreation, then suddenly it becomes easy to normalize sex between people of the same sex. Because if procreation isn't a necessary thing that's tied up with sex, then any form of sex between two consensual adults is fine, right? That's fair game. So these are just a couple examples, and we could talk about more, of how our culture's confusion about the purpose of sex has led to confusion about the proper place for sex. I think all of us have experienced pain that has resulted specifically from the various ways that we've played with the fire of sex outside of the fireplace of God's intended place. But the Bible is clear, and we need to be clear, that any form of sex outside of God's proper place is a path to folly. It's that path to harm. Sex outside of the covenant of marriage, sex between people of the same sex, watching pornography, sexual harassment, rape, pedophilia, we could go on and on and on. All of these things are terribly harmful to us because they take sex out of that beautiful place God created for it, and they turn it into this destructive thing. Okay, so we need to be clear as Christians that all of this is to be lamented. You know, all we have to do is look at the headlines, right? Like, think about what's happening with Harvey Weinstein and that scandal, and Kevin Spacey, all of these kind of celebrities that are being accused of sexual harassment. That just shows how systemic the brokenness of toxic sexuality is in our culture. It's everywhere, and it's being kind of broadcast through Hollywood and media into our homes and TV. There's so much in our culture that is destructive because it takes the fire of sexuality out of its proper place, and I think it almost gives us matches and gasoline and tells us to play with it, right? And that is just leading to all sorts of pain and all sorts of destruction. I think we as Christians need to be clear and consistent that God's design is good, and anything outside of that design leads to harm. I think too often, unfortunately, Christians have not been consistent, right? We've focused on certain aspects of sexuality that are outside of God's design, and maybe we've been really loud about decrying those, maybe homosexuality, for example. But while we've done that, we've been very quiet and kind of turned the other direction about some other forms of sex outside of God's plan. Maybe couples in our churches who are cohabiting and having sex before marriage, equally outside of God's plan as homosexuality, but why have we focused on one and not the other? I think that inconsistency has unfortunately led to a kind of hampered witness in our culture. Why would anyone listen to what Christians have to say? They've been so hypocritical on this issue. So we need to be clear and consistent about what God's vision is for sexuality and its proper place and purpose. Okay, so now getting to that third question, what does it look like to be embracing God's countercultural vision for sexuality, this life-giving, beautiful wisdom that he offers us regarding sexuality? I actually want to talk about four ways that I think we can do this in terms of embracing God's vision for sexuality. And the first one is kind of fundamental, but kind of roll with me here because I think it's super important that we get this right. And the first way we can embrace God's vision for sexuality is embracing and accepting gender difference. Okay, part of the sexual confusion, I think, that we're facing in our culture today, and just the frustration we see in our own lives, is that we've rejected God's design for us in terms of male-female gender difference. We've rejected the beautiful givenness of these biological categories. Instead, we've kind of turned gender into this fluid kind of spectrum that's more about my kind of self-identity and what I feel like I am than it is about kind of the Y or X chromosomes that God has in his kindness given to us. He's chosen that for us, but we, you know, in our pride have as a culture, we've rejected that. But we as Christians need to see the complementary categories of male and female equal but different and created for each other in this beautiful way, as we see in Genesis 2. We need to see this as foundational and beautiful, a beautiful part of God's creation. You know, in Genesis 1, 27, when it talks about the image of God, it says, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So that is so interesting, and it's super significant that when God talks about creating us in his image, he specifically calls out the two sexes, male and female. So there's something about the relationality of those two sexes, their relationship to one another, their being made for one another, reflects the image of God in a profound, mysterious way. It means that we weren't created to be alone. We're not fully human alone. We become fully human in relationship. That's what Genesis 1:27 is saying. And so we need to embrace that, that beautiful complementarity of these two genders that help, it helps me as a man become fully human in relationship with women and vice versa. We are relational beings created in the image of a relational God. Okay, that's a super important concept. Peter Kreeft, who's a theologian that I like, he has a really helpful image that I think is beautiful in terms of like a metaphor for describing the complementary relationship of men and women. And he talks about this in terms of water and rock. And his kind of metaphor, water is like the female, the feminine, and male is the rock. That's the masculine. And he says this, water and rock are deeply satisfying together. And we can't quite analyze why we find that satisfaction and that peace and that sense of rightness. The shore is the most popular place on earth. Waterfront property is the most expensive property anywhere in the world because that's where the sea and the land meet. That's where man and woman meet. The land without the sea is kind of boring. It's desert. The sea without the land is kind of boring. When are we going to land the ship? But the place where they meet, that's where the action is. That's where we want to be. God's creational order is male and female, created for each other in this profound way. And as Christians, we need to celebrate this and accept this in a culture that has rejected it. And, you know, we can model this not only in marriage, but also in other relationships. So, you know, if you're single here and thinking this doesn't apply to you, no, like all of us, married or single, can live out this relationality in our relationships, whether with brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, just friendships that are kind of mixed-sex friendships. All of that kind of is us bearing God's image as a relational God through our relational wiring, the way he created us to be. You know, 10 years ago, I was 24. I wasn't married. Kira was not even on the radar at that point. I was a single guy at that point, not in any sort of romantic relationship, but I was no less sexually a male then as I am now. And I think it's important for single people to recognize that you too are a sexual being, as a male or a female. And there's ways to express that in that relationality sense, even as a single person. So 10 years ago, I had a great community of fellow single people, both men and women, and we just had an intimate, deep community. We would go on trips together, we would have holidays together, and you know, there. Even then, we were kind of expressing this image of God relationality, right? The men in our group, the women in our group, there wasn't the physical sex kind of aspect happening, but that's not the only expression of the deep relationality that is the image of God in us. Sex is one physical manifestation of that, but our sexuality can be expressed in deep friendship and kind of intimate community. And so I would challenge us as a community here, if you're single here today, lean into the Christian church. Even if you're married, like we are all one family, that intimate community needs to be a priority. We can't just withdraw into our own kind of nuclear family bubbles. We can be countercultural in being a deep community where that relationality, men and women together, spiritual fathers, spiritual mothers, spiritual sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, can be one kind of expression of that beautiful relationality. Okay, so the acceptance of our male and female gender sexuality is one way that we honor our Creator's vision for the good life in sexuality. The second way that I think we can embrace God's wisdom in sexuality is by celebrating the goodness of sex. I think, unfortunately, Christians have not had a good reputation for this. We've kind of had the reputation of being a little bit, like, prudish about sex, kind of sex is bad, like, it's mostly just something to stay away from. That's kind of how our culture views Christians as it relates to sex. Like, oh, they're kind of the party poopers about sex. And that shouldn't be the case. Like, as we saw in this passage, like, Proverbs verses 18 and 19, like, it makes very clear that sex in its proper place is a beautiful thing, right? Let your fountain be blessed, it says. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. Let her breasts fill you at times with delight. Be intoxicated in her love. Like, that language is joyful and pleasurable. And we need to, like, acknowledge that and celebrate that aspect of sexuality as Christians. This was not the sort of approach that I grew up in, unfortunately. Some of you might relate to this, but I grew up in, like, a very conservative Baptist upbringing, grew up a Christian. Sex in my upbringing was a taboo thing. It was not something you talked about. I grew up on, like, true love waits and kind of, like, sex is mostly just about abstinence and kind of, you know, don't even talk about it, stay far away from it. And I don't think that was a good thing. What the result of that, the fact that we never talked about it, I didn't talk about it with my family really ever, we didn't talk about it in youth group, in church, it has the effect of making sex a thing of shame. It makes our sexuality a thing of shame. Like, we can't talk about it, we don't know what to say about it. It's mostly just this kind of bad category that we want to stay away from. But we need to not be that way today. We need to talk positively about the beauty of sex. Parents need to talk positively about the beauty of sex to your kids. It shouldn't be a thing of embarrassment. It shouldn't be something you ignore. You know, in this passage of Proverbs where it talks about, you know, be intoxicated, enjoy the fountain, your own cistern, the water from your own cistern, this is the Bible telling us that sex is good and we should enjoy it. And there's other passages, the whole book of Song of Solomon is pretty much this same thing. Sex is a beautiful way, like I said earlier, to physically express that kind of relationality of being made in God's image, male and female being made for each other. So we need to be a church that doesn't downplay that, but celebrates the beauty of that in its proper place, in its context. But we need to also, we need to go beyond that too. So we need to celebrate the pleasure of sexuality, but we need to also seek a higher purpose for it. And that's my third challenge for us this morning. We need to seek a higher purpose for sexuality. You know, in our world today, it's reduced the purpose of sexuality merely to pleasure, right? That's what we talked about earlier. And it is about pleasure, and we need to celebrate that, but as Christians, we need to say and we need to live in a way that communicates it's about more than sexual, it's about more than just our individual pleasure. It, for example, it is also about procreation. We need to reclaim that idea that a beautiful aspect of what sex is about creating new lives, following God's commandment in Genesis 1 to be fruitful and multiply. We need to see this as not just kind of another consumer activity, like, oh, I want a kid just like they have a kid. Like, I want to collect kids and, like, be like a nice, happy family. We need to see childbearing and procreation in missional terms. The context of Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply, is in a missional sense. Having children in this dark world as Christians is about bringing new lights into the world to counteract the darkness. That's one of God's purposes for sex, is missional. It's about be fruitful and multiply in this dark world. So we need to be obedient to that as married couples. You know, some of you know Kira and I are trying to have a child of our own right now. We've been trying for about a year. And, you know, it is an up and down roller coaster. It's not an easy process when you've kind of made that decision to really try for a child and it doesn't happen immediately. And you know, even very recently, it's been hard for us. But one of the upsides to this process, and I hope it's not saying too much, Kira, that you're right here, it's kind of awkward, but one of the upsides has been our sex life has never been better, because there's something about kind of actually, like, having sex for the purpose for which it was intended. There's something right and natural and beautiful about that. Okay, so procreation is an essential purpose of sex, and we need to reclaim that in a culture that, like I said earlier, the birth control pill kind of severed that tie and said, nope, sex is just about pleasure. Don't worry about that whole like procreation thing. We need to reunify that and see that as a beautiful thing. But it also goes beyond procreation, because the fact is not every couple has children or can have children. And it may be the case that Kira and I can't have children. So for couples like that, is the purpose of sex just pleasure? No, like there's an even higher purpose for sex. And what it is this: it glorifies God. It's an image of God. You know, this one flesh union, this expression of that relationality in marriage through sex, is it's a way to image Christ in the church. So Ephesians 5 talks about marriage as an image of Christ's love for the church, and this idea of sacrificing for the other, giving yourself for the other. And sex is one, it's a physical kind of image of that idea of giving of yourself sacrificially for one another. And so that's a purpose for sex. It's a beautiful image of how Christ sacrificially lays his life down for another. And you know, sex is a vulnerable thing. Even within marriage, it's a very vulnerable thing, but it is about giving to one another in this sacrificial way that, again, isn't that inward orientation that our culture says of sex is about you getting pleasure. If we approach sex in the sense of giving of ourselves, loving our spouses, then we're imaging Christ in his kind of sacrificial posture. And that leads me to my final challenge for us, and that is that we need to embrace the cost of sexuality, because the thing about sexual ethics in Christianity is that it's going to be costly for everyone. We live in this world that sexuality is ubiquitous, right? Sexual temptation is everywhere. It's on our phones. It's two clicks away at any given time. Sexuality comes at us from every direction, and the message of our culture is sexual freedom. Like, do what you want to do. Like, don't let any religious people judge you. Like, that's the context we live in. So in this context, to embrace God's wisdom for sexuality, which is a yes to pleasure and joy in its proper place, but it's also a no to sex, any context outside of that, to do that is costly. It's very costly, and it's especially costly, I think, for single people who have to live faithfully without sex in a very, very sexualized world. And there are a lot of single people in our community, and it's tough. Like, how do you steward your sexuality as a single person in a world like this? Abstaining from sex while at the same time not denying your sexuality. You were created as a male or a female. So how do you do that? How do you embrace your sexuality but not kind of take kind of that outside of the fireplace aspect of sex that our culture says is okay? So it's costly for single people. It's also costly for single people who experience same-sex attraction. And there are people like that. There are brothers and sisters like that in our community. And for them, the struggle with celibacy is not only, you know, the temptation is everywhere, but it's this emotional struggle that is the idea that my sexual desires may never be realized. There's not a hope for that for me, because there is no fireplace of God's design for same-sex sexuality in terms of that physical union. And so for them, there's this deep pain of facing a lifetime of loneliness, of facing this the prospect of never having that deep one-flesh connection with someone. And you know, Kira and I have walked with people like this. We've walked both with kind of the single person in that first category who's just struggling with being single and having that void of sexual intimacy in their life. But we've also walked with people in this community who are facing that same-sex attraction challenge and that fear of wanting intimacy deeply. They have a deep need for relationship. Like I talked about earlier, we are wired for relationship. And so whenever we feel like we aren't going to be able to express that in this life, it's a source of great pain. So we as a community need to realize we can provide deep, intimate relationships even beyond sex. Like we can be a community that is family for the broken in our midst who aren't going to be able to maybe be married. So we need to recognize that these stories exist and they're costly, that there's a cost associated with following God's plan for wisdom and sexuality. But in this cost, we can know Jesus more. And I want to kind of land with talking about Jesus a bit, because, you know, Jesus was a sexual being himself. We don't often talk about Jesus in this way, but he was a sexual man. Like, he was a male with a Y chromosome. He had armpit hair. He had male sexual organs. He lived a sexed life as a biological male, but he lived a sexless life. He was celibate. And here's what that means for us. Here's the important consequence of that. It means we can live faithfully as sexual beings by virtue of embracing our maleness and our femaleness, like I talked about earlier. We can do that without actually having sex, without being sexually active, because Jesus did it. He lived a contented life this way, and so it's possible. Hebrews 4:15 says this: Jesus was in every respect tempted as we are, yet without sin. And I'm sure that tempted in every way, like we are, I'm sure that included sexual temptation. So we do not have a Savior who is unable to sympathize with our struggles, with our weakness. He's been there as well. He knows what it's like to die to our desires that are very real desires. And so we are called to do the same. Wherever we are in our journey of sexuality, we are called to this costly sacrifice of dying to our desires. If you're singles, you know, the sacrifice for you is celibacy, but it's also the call to give your life away to others in community. Be vulnerable still in giving yourself away for the church, for community. And for married couples, it's the call is similar. Like, the sacrifice is giving yourself sexually to your spouse and to your children that are the offspring of your sexual union, but it's also this giving yourself away to community. Give yourself away to the single people in this church. Invite them over for meals. Like, build community with them because they need it. They need this family. The Christian view of sex is more about sacrifice than self-interest. And this is really the kind of the big takeaway in terms of how we're different from the world. Sex in the world is about pleasure. It's about me. It's about self-interest. The Christian view of sex is about sacrifice. And we need to live in that way. We need to be honest about the challenges that are in our midst. We need to be open. We need to talk about these things. We need to be a community where people can bring their sexual brokenness into honest, vulnerable conversation. You know, the world, there's this term that out there called sexual orientation, right? We've all heard this term, sexual orientation. It's actually a very new term in history. Like, 100 years ago, like, no one would have even known what we're talking about. It wasn't a thing, sexual orientation. I want to suggest today that a better way for us as Christians to think about this is sexual disorientation, because we know that in a fallen world, sin has caused sexual disorientation in all of us. Every single one of us has some aspect of sexual disorientation in our story. We struggle with temptations. We struggle with desires that are about drawing the fire out of that fireplace. And we have all been disoriented in this area, prone to kind of wander from the right path of God's wisdom to our own path of folly. And yet, Christ redeems our sexual disorientation. His grace covers all of the ways that we are disoriented, all the ways that we are broken in sexuality, and he offers us hope for healing. So as a community, we need to take hold of that grace. We need to apply that grace both to ourselves in the ways that we are sexually broken and to each other. We've all made mistakes. We've all been burned by the fire of sex. Like, all of us could tell stories of that. We all have scars. And we need to be a community that is one that celebrates the beauty of the fireplace of sex in its proper place, but we also need to function as sort of like a trauma center, like a burn center. Right? Because all of us come here with wounds from the fire of sex. All of us come here with scars, and we need to be a place where healing can occur. And, you know, Kyler had this great image this morning before the service about fire. And when you have a fire wound, it's one of the hardest wounds to heal. Like, skin, when it's burned, is one of the hardest things to heal. And ultimately, what you have to do is you have to have a skin graft. Someone else's skin needs to be put on your wounds to make you whole again. And as Christians, that's the image of the gospel, right? Jesus died so that in his wounds, through his body being broken, our bodies can be healed. So He offers us skin grafts to heal the burns of sexuality that mark our bodies and mark our hearts. So we need to be a burn center. We need to be a trauma center for this issue, because we live in a world where the fire is raging out of control. It's consuming many of our families, many of our lives. All of us have scars. But the Church of Jesus Christ is a place where we can heal together. We can bind up each other's wounds and burns and scars. Jesus restores us. He takes the shame that we might feel in this issue. He takes it upon himself, and he offers us the chance for newness, for restoration and wholeness.